Hello, Big Mouth listeners, and welcome to a special bonus edition of the internet's spiffiest pop culture talk show. We've got a couple of unusual guests for this one-off show. They're two brothers who are now in their 45th year of a working musical partnership. Since they started to write together at home in Pacific Palisades, California in 1972, they've done glam rock, electronic disco with the great Giorgio Moroder, baroque, alternative and art pop. They've written a musical about Ingmar Bergman, and they invented an entirely new form of orchestral pop, possibly co-created by their secret alter ego, Lil Beethoven. Their fans include Andy Warhol, Morrissey, Franz Ferdinand, with whom they made a complete original album in 2015, Björk and Justin Hawkins of the Darkness, who definitely borrowed their signature vocal sound. They are Ron and Russell Male, better known as Sparks. Hello, Ron and Russell. Welcome to London. How are you?
Thanks.
Hello.
We're fine.
Good.
Now,
good and unusual.
Good so, and unusual. Yeah. And we're recording in Soho. Is this the Soho you remember from when you were here in the early 1970s?
Yeah, I mean, it still looks the same. It was the only place I remember that you could get a good coffee, like a proper cappuccino at that time, because there obviously weren't the chains, the Starbucks, or any place where you could get just, you know, Pret a Manger, anything, just to get a cappuccino, you know. So you have to come to Soho. So yeah, that still remains.
That's all you get in Soho now. Isn't
yeah, you, you can't get any coffee now, yeah. But except yeah. It's £18 each.
Yeah.
We also were surviving completely on Chinese food and Indian food, and so we came down to Chinatown a lot every other day.
Yeah. Do you think it's been cleaned up a bit too much? Leading question.
I think it's been cleaned up a bit too much.
I think that too.
The old charm, the old Soho.
Well, I strongly suggest that you go shopping. You should definitely go to Marks and Spencer's now, because when you pay, it says, have you swiped your Sparks card?
I know. We've taken many photos in front of you.
Just like holding up your Sparks card.
Yeah,
have Sparks got Sparks cards?
I haven't got one. I have to apply.
Surely they'd have to give you like the black Sparks card that gets you loads of free stuff.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have a word.
Yeah.
You heard him speaking a moment earlier. We've also got mega Sparks fan and Big Mouth regular Eamon Ford in with us today to help us interrogate Ron and Russell. Eamon, what's your favourite Sparks song?
I had to think about this, and I had to filter it down to three, because I can't filter it, because you've made so many songs. I got Slow Boat,
yes,
Waterproof, and Those Mysteries. They're my three favourite Sparks songs this week.
This week, but we'll get you back next week and ask you another one. It's always good to ask you what your favourite songs are from the people who made them, so don't go puce.
The next question, what's your least favourite?
No.
All the other ones. I only like those three.
I like your choices because they aren't the obvious ones that everybody throws out by looking on Wikipedia. And then
he's just trying to impress you.
I just picked albums at random.
He looked on Wikipedia for the obscure Sparks.
Obscure Sparks.
There's only three listed there. It's those three.
So we're going to tag team you. I've got the conventional questions. Eamon's got the weird ones. I'm going to start. Now, we just heard at the top of the show, we heard Edith Piaf said it better than me from your new album, Hippopotamus. It's a typically atypical record with songs about God being annoyed by people constantly praying to him, about Scandinavian design, the joys of the missionary position, all commonplace and typical subjects like that. Ron, as in many respects the principal songwriter, do you go around making notes of subjects that sound like they could be in a Sparks song? Like, you know, when you're in IKEA or when you're in a chip shop or when you're in a motorway services. That sounds like a Sparks song.
Well, it actually works the other way around. We start with the music first, and then hopefully a title comes at the time of the writing of the music. But we always work kind of the other way around, where the music is there. And it kind of, to us, it kind of feels less restrictive. If you start with the title and the lyrics, then you're forced into that kind of even metric flow. Mm. And we kind of like to chop up measures into two beats and all that sort of thing. So the even the titles come after the music. A song like Hippopotamus on the new album, we wrote the music and we were kind of searching for a title, and it seemed like an unusual track, and Hippopotamus kind of flowed right on in there.
So you'll find yourself with a piece of music and you'll go, this to me sounds like it's about the missionary position.
Something like that, yeah.
I think not everybody kind of understands exactly what your writing process is. I mean, is it, to what extent, Ron, is it you putting words into Russell's mouth and going like, this is what Russell will sing?
Well, in a certain sense, I guess. I mean, if you're a songwriter and you're writing for, I kind of never really think of it being songs specifically for Russell's voice, but they're songs that are kind of idiosyncratic, and Russell's voice is idiosyncratic, so you know, they kind of work. I mean, we don't even have to speak about it anymore. It just, I mean, a lot of the things are things that aren't necessarily melodies that are normally singing melodies. They might be more instrumental melodies that Russell sings. So it's kind of different than a normal vocalist role within a band.
Mm-hmm. But has he written any lyrics that you absolutely refuse to sing, saying, no way? A song maybe called Ron's the Best One?
That was rejected on the latest album. Yeah, he did have that.
Yeah, on the first album that was rejected.
You got to keep going. You got to make it happen. Yeah. But related to that, your brothers in bands are notorious for not getting on. It's a combustible relationship. The Kinks, Jesus, Mary Chain, Oasis. It seems to be only you and the Proclaimers that are the brothers in music that seem to get on. How do you do that? What's the magic to maintaining that relationship, particularly being on the road as well?
Yeah, I mean, we don't think about, I mean, it's just we think the other bands that you mentioned, it's odd that they're brothers and they don't get along. You know, it's a odd thing that there's seems to be like for so much animosity between the Gallagher. You know, you kind of can't understand how that even exists. So for us, it's kind of natural the other way. So
what's the worst thing you've ever fallen out about?
Well, there's nothing musically on a grand scale that we have, you know, major debate. There's like more specific little things, but the grand scheme and the grand thrust of what Sparks wants to be doing, we kind of see eye to eye, and there's not, we kind of have this unspoken mission statement that we kind of adhere to, and we both, you know, subscribe to that, and so there aren't those kinds of conflicts that seem to be prevailing with, you know, other brother acts, and I don't know why.
You should fall out and make an album and see what it sounds like.
Yeah, maybe we will. Yeah. We'll try that.
Okay, do
good
it.
Gimmick.
Yeah. What are the occupational hazards of following Sparks? And as a long-time follower, one of the great things about it that you enjoy as a fan is you like one record, the next one may be entirely, utterly different in a completely different idiom. This is not the way you're supposed to do it in the world of rock. You're supposed to be consistent. There's supposed to be a through line. You're supposed to know what you're going to be getting. When you start work on a record, do you begin with an idea of, okay, it's going to be different in this direction? What were you thinking about with Hippopotamus, for instance?
Well, in this case, we had been working pretty extensively on a movie musical, a film that we were working on with the French director, Léos Carax, and it was kind of an idea that we had developed, and so we're working kind of in a long narrative situation that's kind of different than the discrete 3 and 4 minute pop songs that we're used to working in. And then we did the FFS project, the collaboration with Franz Ferdinand, and we kind of got re-inspired to, this is really fun being in a band again and doing those kinds of songs. So we kind of felt the challenge of seeing whether after doing so many albums we could be inspired enough to do an album of you know, what to us is traditional pop songs, maybe not to everybody, but to us it is, and seeing if we could really get excited about what we were doing. And when we started working on the album, it really felt like something special.
So the Radical Bizarre Movies, let's be a rock band. What would that be like?
It's a concept.
Yeah, absolutely. Eamon.
Yes, before Sparks existed, you were Half Nielsen, and you were signed to Bearsville, which was Albert Grossman's label.
That's right.
Short-lived label, I think. Well, you did two albums on that. But was he trying to force you into his comfort zone, which is basically turn people into folk duos or folk trios?
No, he was. To his credit, he's the one actually responsible for naming Sparks Sparks, because we had released the first album under the name Half Nelson, and Albert Grossman, he was associated with groups like you mentioned, as Bob Dylan. Called folk
Peter
music.
Paul and Mary.
Yeah, and so it was seemed like kind of completely alien to what Sparks was or to what Half Nelson was doing at the time. And so, to his credit, you know, he really loved what we were doing, which was so different from those other acts. And he was disappointed that the first album, the Half Nelson album, when it was released, that it didn't have more of a commercial impact, and so he was trying to figure out why that was. And he thought that maybe the name Half Nelson was just too obscure sounding of a name and that no one understood that, and that that was the whole problem. There's nothing to do with us musically was being the problem for not reaching more people. So he thought we were very funny people and we were brothers. So he said, you remind me of the Marx Brothers. You guys should be the Sparks Brothers. And, and so taste wise, we thought everything he had was associated was really good, except for that title suggestion we thought was really horrible. And so we said, well, we'll meet you halfway and we'll lop off the brothers bit and we'll accept the Sparks part. And so, yeah. And then they released that album and, it didn't do a lot better at commercials. He's not a genius.
And yet, 40 years later, Marks and Spencer's are on board. So, you know,
that's right.
But no, with things like Glow, wrestling's trendy again. So maybe this is the time to bring back
the Half Nelson. The Half Nelson reunion. Well, they don't need to split up. They are actually here. So,
yeah.
I wanted to ask you, Russell, obviously one of the massive trademarks of Sparks is your own heroic falsetto, which soars over the mountain ranges like nobody's business. A, where did it come from? And B, is it arduous to maintain that for an entire show? It seems like a strenuous singing style.
Oh, I mean, it is. It's because the one thing I'm, you know, when people come to see Sparks, you know, you just don't want to let people down and have any reason to say like, wow, the singing was so much better back then and that sort of thing. And so there's, you know, I take kind of pride in trying to make it be as you know, like it has been, in, you know, had been in the past. And it is something because, you know, singers with with age, you tend to lose the range, you know, your vocal range gets lowered. And a lot of artists, they change the keys of their songs later on. And to the unsuspecting public, you probably wouldn't know. But there's a quality of singing things in the original key that there's a, it's kind of this thing you kind of went, why does it not sound exactly how it sounded when such and such artist is singing that song now? And sometimes because the keys have been lowered. So in any case, we want to try to do things in the original keys, and also just to so that people don't have an excuse to say, God, you're just singing really good. What happened? And but so it is, you know, just taking care of yourself to
where
be able to
do it. Where
did
it come from in the first place? It's such an unusual
style. I think a lot of it was just dictated by the way Ron's songs were written. Like he had mentioned earlier, that a lot of them are written, the melodies are written on a keyboard, and so he doesn't really care. Hey, there's a Gallagher moment coming up. He doesn't really care if the singer can sing that
your problem, mate.
Ain't my problem, though.
Yeah, he's done his job. And so, and that's, I think, is different than a lot of songwriters where they kind of strum a guitar and then sing along to the chords that they've done. But sometimes he'll write a melody on a piano, and those melodies are often, you know, they're pretty they're all over the map, so to speak.
And the other thing is when we are playing live, the structure of the songs is different than most bands, because there aren't kind of places where the vocals aren't doing something. They're usually there aren't instrumental passages so much in our songs, and so it's kind of constant singing and kind of shifting areas. It isn't like it isn't always repeating. So it's kind of a, you know, for an hour and a half, it's a lot for...
You're basically torturing your brother for an hour and a half.
That's one way of putting it.
There's a lot of lyrics, and they tend not to repeat a lot of the time, with the exception of My Baby's Taking Me Home, which is like a mantra of sorts. But... so it's like, it's a twofold thing, having to remember all those lyrics and then to be able to sing them the way they're
It's very hard to remember lyrics and My Baby's Taking Me Home. Amy, you have a question?
Yes. You mentioned earlier FFS. So you did the album with Franz Ferdinand, and then after that album was done, poor old Nick McCarthy left Franz Ferdinand. What on earth did you do to him? You drove him out.
It wasn't us that drove him out. Enough said.
Everyone makes their choices, you know.
And we like Nick.
It was those shows were really, you know, we played 41 live dates with them, and you know, every one of the shows was really exciting. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, it really was part of the inspiration for us to do this album, working in that in that general context.
But how was it sharing songwriting duties? Because obviously you're in terms of the history of sports, yeah, you're quite autonomous in terms of you've done the lion's share of everything. So
yeah,
how did your ego handle that? Having
it's really difficult. But when you enter that kind of situation, and also with a band that, you know, is really strong and has an identity, you have to relinquish some of the control. It's difficult for us, and especially as a songwriter, but you enter into the situation knowing that that's going to be the case, and hoping that the some of the parts will maybe be bigger, you know, than each of the separate.
Was it a relief that you only had to learn half the lyrics then?
It was, yeah. It makes it a lot easier.
It's like a week off for you, isn't it? Right. So, Ron, I've asked Russell about his trademark falsetto. Well, I have to ask you about one of your trademark things, the famous Ron moustache. Now, you made an enormous impression when you first appeared because you had what we will refer to as the toothbrush moustache. John Lennon famously said, "Why is Hitler on the television?" Fess up, was it a Hitler moustache or was it another moustache?
No, I mean, I was always inspired by silent comedians and Oliver Hardy. I mean, he started off silent and then he was in speaking parts. But Oliver Hardy and Charlie Chaplin were kind of the inspiration. I just, you know, I had early on, we had gotten together as a band and we were kind of dreaming of being a British band. So everybody had their trademark copy of what, you know, what the Who were doing or any, you know, all of the English bands that we were trying to emulate. But as a keyboard player, it was really difficult to find my role, you know, what I was going to do. And I wasn't kind of the Rick Wakeman jumping around cape kind of guy. And so I just kind of went a different direction.
So 1920s, Cap Calloway.
Yeah, no, exactly, you know. And so, you know, I kind of wasn't aware enough of the other kind of connotations of the mustache. I mean, I should have been, but the time when it kind of really came to light to me in a way where I knew I had to make a change was we were booked on a French TV show sometime maybe in the late 70s, and the host of the show, who I guess wasn't aware of Sparks, saw the picture and said, "We can't have them on." And so I decided maybe the point of having that it's not worth it, you know, if that's going to be even the reaction of a very small group of people. And that, you know, was never the intention. We like to offend people, but
but in
not,
a nice way.
Well, but not in that kind of way.
You mentioned that in the song Moustache. You say, when I trimmed it really small, my Jewish friends wouldn't call.
Well, there you go. Every song is autobiographical.
How did you feel when you saw Paul McCartney being you in the video for it?
That was,
wasn't it? Yeah.
No, that was, you know, it was a thrill, you know, just to even know that he knew that we existed was really something really special. And he did probably a better me than me,
I think. Yes. When you were kind of coming of age in music, you were obviously hanging around on Sunset Strip when it was kind of in its prime. So the Whiskey and places like that. But a lot of the bands associated with that, like Love, The Doors, Buffalo Springfield, The Birds, they're not really known for their sense of humour. They're very po-faced. What on earth did you find to like about a lot of those bands that were happening in LA at the time? It seemed quite a very serious kind of scene. And obviously Sparks are kind of the diametric opposite of that.
Yeah, I mean, some of those bands you mentioned we actually liked, but there was a, you know, like a seriousness in a different way, like The Doors, where it's like sort of, I mean, we love The Doors, but it's kind of like this spacey poetry that Jim Morrison was kind of, you know, the crystal ship is leaving, you know, kind of, well, what the hell, you know, and so it was, but we, you know, we like those bands. We preferred the bands you mentioned more than just some of the other LA bands, like the more Laurel Canyon scene of the, they're all good artists and everything, but, you know, the Jackson Brown, Joni Mitchells of the world, where it was kind of like even more, serious in a way that, I mean, what we're doing is incredibly serious, we think, but there's different ways of presenting your seriousness, and so we just and for those bands too, the ones like the Laurel Canyon scene, it was kind of like the antithesis of what we liked about bands, where we thought, you know, that the image mattered, that you know, how you present yourself on stage mattered. And those bands, there seemed to be like this different kind of earnestness where you go on and you bare your soul, but in a way to us that was less engaging for our sensibility.
Mm. I mentioned it earlier, there are a myriad of Spark styles. There's disco Sparks, Beat the Clock, Start Time. There's Baroque Pop, Little Beethoven. There's indie rock Sparks like FFS. Is there anything on the list that you think we really need to get round to doing this? I mean, we haven't had reggae Sparks. We haven't had country Sparks. We haven't had goth Sparks.
EDM Sparks?
No, we don't want EDM Sparks. Have we got anything on the list?
I'm writing all these down, okay. So you might hear them in the future. I mean, it kind of depends. I mean, the only time we've really been actually made a decision about the style rather than just kind of working from the songs was at the time of Little Beethoven, because we felt that we kind of gone as we had written 20 songs for that, what was to be the next album then, and it just seemed a little bit like we were going through the motions, and we don't want to have that feeling, and so we decided just to scrap those songs, which, you know, as a songwriter, that's kind of the most difficult thing of anything to do, but to try to reinvent how we were doing the songs. And so we have the luxury now of having our own studio, and so we just decided just to not have a preconceived idea, but to try to reinvent, you know, what's important in the sound of a song, and maybe drums and guitars don't have to be the main pushing propulsive element, that it can be really driving strings and kind of repetitive vocals that take those roles. So that was kind of the thought of that. But in general, we don't really think of the direction. You know, there is one other time, but just when we worked with Giorgio Moroder, because it was also a time when we were really wanting to do something stylistically different. And we had heard I Feel Love, and it, you know, he seemed like the person to be able to work with to kind of reinvent the context, musical context of how we were working.
I'm going to hold out the reggae box. I and I married myself. Okay. That's what I want to hear.
Yeah.
Avon.
Yeah. We talked about being brothers in bands, but what if one of you had been a girl? Could you have been Sparks with that male-female dynamic, or would you have ended up sounding like the Carpenters?
A lot of people thought that it was a girl anyway, so well, okay. It didn't really matter.
Yeah. Would you have sung in a lower register then?
We
tried it on the cover of Angst in My Pants, yeah. And it didn't work so well.
I thought it looked rather nice in it.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah, of course it could always have been Ron who'd been born a girl. So, you know, you never knew.
Yeah,
more female energy in the music. I don't know. Just to finish up then, I mean, you're in your 45th year in pop and you're still touring. You're still in the new and alternative category of different music to be discovered. How would you get someone who'd somehow never encountered Sparks to try Hippopotamus and maybe come to a show? What would you say? We are Sparks and we do this.
Well, I mean, that's kind of it's a byproduct of the new album, is just the thing that if someone was completely unaware of the band, that can this album, the new album, be something that you'd say would represent for you to a new person to say, just listen to this one album first as a starting point, and hopefully this album will be as compelling to someone who's unaware of Sparks as maybe Take Any Album, Come On to My House was back in its time to someone that didn't know Sparks either. And so that's kind of like how we approach this album, just saying, well, we've got to do something that will be something that'll shake things up and will hopefully be fresh and vital and 2017-ish for somebody that doesn't have any awareness of Sparks. And can this album Hippopotamus represent that for them? And we think it does.
So basically, after 45 years, you've made your debut album.
Exactly.
Yeah,
we have.
Okay, well, we're going to play out with the title track from Hippopotamus, which is out on September the 8th. Thank you, Eamon, for helping me with it with the questionings. Sparks, tell us about the title track to Hippopotamus.
Well, Hippopotamus is a song, a sequential kind of song about a guy who goes outside, has a pool, and discovers a hippopotamus in there and wonders why it's there. And then gradually there are more and more objects in the pool. A lot of things that by coincidence rhyme with hippopotamus, Volkswagen microbuses and Titus Andronicus. And in the end, you know, most songs you have to have kind of a conclusion and where is this going? But this song doesn't have that kind of conclusion. It's yes, so grand is like the end. It's like just the person is just kind of dumbstruck by all
is
this.
Is it your take on the woman who swallowed a fly rhyme? Because it seems to me it escalates.
Yeah, no, that was kind of it. I mean, I don't like to be kind of tied down to rhyming dictionaries, but to kind of come up with things that didn't sound like obviously you're just kind of lining up all the words that rhyme with hippopotamus that would kind of actually mean something in the song. And then after the fact, you notice that there are rhymes. It is that kind of situation.
Ron and Russell, thank you so much for coming into the Big Mouth Studio. We're going to have a listen now. This is Preposterous. It Sparks with Hippopotamus.
There's a hippopotamus, a hippopotamus, a hippopotamus in my pool. There's a hippopotamus, a hippopotamus, a hippopotamus in my pool. How did it get there? How did it get there? How did it get there? I don't know. How did it get there? How did it get there?